from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, 10 people are dead after a mass shooting at Oregon's Umpqua Community College yesterday, adding to the more than 40 school shootings this year alone. We open the phone lines to get your thoughts on the Oregon tragedy and our country's epidemic of mass shootings. Then at 9:30, Senators Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein added their voices this week to the call to exonerate 50 African-American soldiers who defied an act of racism but were convicted of mutiny during World War II. We'll learn more about the so-called Port Chicago 50 and the prospects for their names being cleared after more than 70 years. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Charleston, Newtown, Aurora, and now Umpqua Community College in Oregon, where 10 people are dead from a mass shooting, including the gunman. The U.S. is a global leader in mass killings, and yesterday's rampage in Roseburg is one of more than 40 school shootings this year. In this first half-hour forum, we examine what makes the U.S. fertile ground for such horrific events and the toll it's taking on our nation. But first, for the latest in Oregon, joining me is Chris Lehman. He is Salem correspondent for the Northwest News Network. Chris Lehman, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
So we've heard that 9 were killed by the gunman and as many as 9 others wounded. Can you tell us anything about the status of the injured?
This morning there are a few whose conditions have been improved, but it's expected that some of them may be hospitalized for a while. But that's about all I can tell you at this point.
Have we been learning about anything about those who were killed in the tragedy?
At this point, we know very little about those who were killed. We don't know their names, for instance. It's presumed that they were, either students or staff or faculty at the college, since that's where the shooting occurred. So we can say that at least, but we don't know anything because those names haven't been released. The sheriff yesterday said it could be 24 to 48 hours, so we may start to hear that later today.
And you're expecting to get an update today, is that right?
That's right. There's the sheriff and law enforcement will give an update in about 1 hour from now. Oregon's governor will speak in a couple of hours. We expect possibly to get some updates at that point. But some of the press briefings they did yesterday, they said very little new at any given time. So we're not sure what we'll learn.
Are we any closer to a motivation for the killings? There were reports that the gunman singled out Christians. Have you heard anything around that?
I've seen those reports as well. I have not personally talked to anybody who has told me that. As far as, in some cases, a gunman will have posted a manifesto or something like that, or, that has not surfaced at this point. There's been some social media postings and profiles that were alleged to have been done by him that painted a picture of somebody who was interested in mass shootings, but that doesn't speak to a specific motive, obviously, in this particular situation.
The community held a candlelight vigil last night. I understand that the school's interim president, Rita Cavan, spoke there. What did she say?
She asked people who were, at the college or, to sort of raise their hands and be recognized. And then, she asked the community members who were there to, raise their hands and show their support, which was a powerful thing. And then she also asked that people not respond with anger right now. She said the community needs love and needs, a peaceful response. Obviously, there's no, with the alleged shooter no longer living, there's not, a specific, vengeance as such that people are calling for, but people can still get very angry in these situations. And she's saying that for now she wants the community to reach out to the victims with words of love and support them in that way.
And how is the community of Roseburg?
Well, in certain respects, if you drive around, it's looks as it did, you know, yesterday at this time before this all happened. But when you talk to people, it's a very somber tone that you hear, and it's certainly something that they. It's a cliche, but when they never expected it to happen in little old Roseburg. It's a logging town. I mean, it is right along the interstate highway. It's not completely isolated, but it's 3 hours south of Portland, so you got to go a ways to get to a major metropolitan area. And it's hunting and fishing and logging and outdoor activities are part of the fabric of life here. And obviously dealing with mass shootings, I mean, nobody's prepared for that, but, you know, especially not in a place like Roseburg.
Well, Chris Lehman, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Chris Lehman, Salem correspondent for the Northwest News Network. I'd like to open the phone lines now. What is your reaction to the Oregon tragedy, the prevalence of mass killings in the United States? This is a half-hour segment, so give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on our Facebook page or on our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me tell you who is joining us for the rest of the half hour. Adam Lankford is criminal justice professor at University of Alabama, and he's author of The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Adam Lankford, thanks for joining us.
Hi, nice to speak with you.
We also have Deb Delvecchio Scully. She is clinical mental health specialist in trauma counseling, and she worked with the Newtown Recovery and Resiliency Team. Welcome, Deb Delvecchio Scully.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Adam Lankford, I'd like to start with you. There are reports that gun deaths will surpass automobile deaths in the U.S. this year, that we have some 33,000 people who die from guns annually. You did a global analysis of public mass shootings. What did you learn about the U.S. and how we rank?
Well, I studied these attackers over a more than 40-year period, and I studied 171 countries, essentially every country for which I could obtain complete data. And despite the fact that we only have 5% of the world's population here in the United States, we had 31% of public mass shooters, so clearly a disproportionate amount. Another way to look at that finding is we were number one in public mass shooters in the world, and we had five times as many attackers as the next highest country.
What makes us such an incubator for mass shooters?
Well, that's a good question. That's what I looked at as well. And the clearest example, according to the statistics, was an empirical link between firearm ownership rate and public mass shooters. So we're also number one in the world in terms of the number of firearms available per civilian. We're number one, and we have 200 million more firearms than anywhere else in the world. So I looked at a variety of other things. I looked at homicide rates, suicide rates, wealth, you know, population being urbanized versus rural, and ultimately firearm seemed to be the clear explanation for why some countries have many more shooters than others and why we have the most.
You mean in terms of firearm availability? And wow, the 200 million number is startling. I mean, what is the, how many, did you get a sense of just how many firearms we have in total?
We have more than one per civilian, especially when you don't include things like babies. So more than 300 million. Some people say 320 million. It's hard to get an exact figure.
You've analyzed the perpetrators of these mass killings, their motives, how they intersect with American cultural values. The gunman is described as 26 years old. There were reports on the New York Times that he was described as withdrawn and anxious, you know, somewhat awkward in social interactions, wore the same outfit every day, very close to his mother. Was there anything about his portrait that spoke to you in terms of what you saw in your research?
Well, I think in terms of what stands out, you know, certainly the social isolation, the mental health problems, there's some indications that he may have been suicidal. You know, those things are all very much textbook in terms of what we see with these attackers. But on the other hand, there are many other people who who have those traits as well and never engage in violence. To me, what really stands out is these internet posts that have been linked to him where he's talking about wanting to be famous, and that he was influenced by previous attackers who he saw that, you know, in one day they went from being anonymous to being infamous, you know, known by everyone. And this particular attacker specifically posted, the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight. That's a theme I've seen with many previous attackers, including the Columbine school shooters. And it's one of the most frustrating elements of this because, in some sense, he's getting what he wanted, even though he's no longer alive.
Deb Dalvecchio-Scully, President Obama said yesterday that this killing means that there's another community stunned with grief. You have been working in Newtown since the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary School, where 20 children were killed. Could you talk a little bit about what you think the community in Oregon is experiencing now as a result of your experience working in Newtown?
Certainly. You know, as a licensed professional counselor, and I'm also a task force member of the American Counseling Association Presidential Anti-Bullying, Anti-Personal Violence Task Force, and, you know, what we know from our training is that this is overwhelm, shock, and disbelief, and indescribable grief and pain that's also has a layer of trauma associated with it. So it's something we describe as traumatic grief. So there are all the symptoms of trauma. So the anxiety, physical symptoms of a rapid heartbeat, feeling on high alert, waiting for something else bad to happen. And unfortunately, this community is just about 24 hours into this horrific event and have a great deal of healing to move through to recover from this.
Do small towns, you know, this is a population of some 22,000, I read, do they experience this differently, say, than larger urban communities, and particularly with the presence of the media coming into the town?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think there are cultures that are part of any community, and so they're a little bit smaller than the Newtown community. I'm not so sure it's the size of the community that matters necessarily. Maybe it's the culture and availability of resources, and that will lead people to healing and recovery. Another absolute layer to the trauma of this event will be the impact of media. And, you know, that's the good news, it's the bad news. They give us great information when it's needed. But that additional layer of being overwhelmed by the media continues to be an issue for us in this community nearly 3 years later. So my advice is for any of the victims' families, anyone directly impacted, is to limit their exposure. Really be mindful about decisions that are made to speak to the media, as those decisions have permanent effect.
I had opened the phone lines earlier, and we're getting a lot of calls. I'd like to go to our listeners. Ellen in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering if we're not experiencing our own kind of radicalization in this country, where we're seeing young men, instead of strapping bombs to themselves and going into a public square, strapping on assault rifles and ammo and going into a heavily populated classroom or you know, or shopping mall or whatever it is, and committing the same acts of violence that we're seeing overseas. It's really quite scary, and kind of it draws a little parallel.
Ellen, thanks. Adam Lankford, you know, you talked about America's sort of adulation of fame. Are we sort of breeding our own brand of radicals with other aspects as well?
Yes. I think, you know, frankly, I've done a lot of research which shows psychological and behavioral links between people we assume to be terrorists, you know, and suicide bombers, and also these other perpetrators of what is essentially mass murder suicide. So, yeah, in terms of kind of cultural values, I am worried about our culture, particularly putting such a premium on fame. So according to the Pew Research Center, 51% of young Americans say to be famous is one of their generation's most important goals. So when people are willing to do anything to be famous, these rare individuals, and then their anger lashes out at different subgroups. So apparently there was some anti-Christian sentiment with this particular attacker, but you know, people who are angry and are willing to do anything to be famous, they'll find a target. You know, we've seen anti-woman, we've seen kind of anti-black, we've seen anti-government, even anti-athlete and jock, you know. So it's a concerning situation, obviously. And the other thing is, in terms of that trauma element, you know, the trauma is similar to terrorism as well in some sense, because these are random innocent victims who never expected this would happen, and those who suffer are far beyond those who are actually injured or wounded or killed.
Ellen, thanks for the call. Beth writes, my concern is these shootings are happening so often that most Americans are becoming desensitized to the point that they're just happy it isn't themselves or loved ones being killed, with the added belief that those in power just don't care. Deb DelVecchio-Scully, you know, the president again said yesterday that mass shootings have become so routine that we become numb to this. And it sounded, you know, so apropos in terms of how we respond to trauma, right, where people who are traumatized tend to become numb to things to be able to cope. Are we in danger of becoming a nation that numbs out to mass shootings because of their prevalence? And what are the consequences of that?
Yes, I do think that that is a risk. You know, numbing is a coping mechanism. You know, as professional counselors, we know that the mind can only deal with so much intensity, and we do different things to help us cope. But on a national level, you know, the dialogue needs to change, right? The understanding of that these kinds of situations do happen everywhere, and that there are many, many mental health professionals and licensed professional counselors throughout the country who are ready and available to make sure that we do the appropriate things, not only to heal from these, because the healing from trauma has to be done by highly trained and professionals, but also to start the narrative about what do we need to do to prevent this.
Adam Langford, do you want to weigh in at all on this question of numbness and how it affects, you know, the prevalence of these types of things and also just sort of the culture of a nation?
Sure. I think, you know, frankly, it's a tricky thing. So I think I was a little concerned about what the president was saying yesterday because, you know, if we give in to that numbness, you know, that becomes the ultimate problem. You know, I'm not numb to it yet. You know, I'm kind of frustrated with it, burned out on it. But, you know, it's an interesting balance. We heard the quote earlier in this show with the idea that save your anger, let's heal now. But frankly, you know, sometimes harnessing that anger leads to major social change as well. So rather than being numb, if people got more angry about this, that actually might be the key to real reform.
A listener writes, President Obama had it right. We are numb to these things and we must expect them to continue on a regular basis until we enact reasonable gun laws. The gun lobby's predictable response is incredibly hypocritical. They say that it is inappropriate to use these events to press for gun regulation, but their so-called respect for the dead and injured is just a tactic to defer such discussions until the most recent event drops off the front page. Chris writes on Facebook, the school was a gun-free zone, unfortunately. The security guard was defenseless, as were the students. Yet the president's reaction was to demagogue on gun control, as if there weren't already over 200 million guns in the country. And let's go to more calls. Scott in Palo Alto. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to preface my comments by stating that I really don't know what the solution is, and I think there's a lot to be worried about. But as a parent who took my daughters to school this morning, I asked myself, you know, what is it that I'm most concerned about? And of course, you're terrified of having this happen in your hometown or your home school. And, you know, we anguish over this, but we're clearly not stopping this. We're not stopping it yet. And I, with all due respect to people who say we need to take guns away, I think that if you do that, you're going to breed a whole different brand of American terrorists. There's lots of people out there just waiting for you to take their gun away, I think. This is my impression. But if I come back to what we might be able to do to, God, I don't want to sound callous, but at least ultra-minimize this type of insanity, we can begin with taking our schools and our education seriously, our education of our children. And, you know, not only do we not pay our teachers nearly enough and give our schools enough resources, but right now it's clear to me that these really are not safe spaces for our children. So if we shift our values, and, you know, to resonate with your last caller, that poor security guard didn't even have a gun on him. I don't even know whose reasoning that is, and who came up with this brilliant idea to have a security guard who's not armed.
Well, Scott, thanks for sharing your perspective. I think I get the sense. I'd like to take more calls. James in Santa Cruz. Go ahead, James.
Hi, good morning. I have one question or one comment. My first question, or my question is, I'm curious about the statistics for the mass shootings in America pre-internet as opposed to post-internet. And my comment is, of all the mass shootings in the country, they're all done by young males. What are we doing, and how are we teaching the males in this country how to process their anger?
James,
I'll take my comments off here.
Thanks, James. Adam Langford, the statistics on mass shootings pre- and post-internet, I know social media has definitely been singled out as potential drivers of these types of things.
Right. So, you know, I think that's it's a reasonable question. You know, even establishing the date for what is pre- and post-internet would be a little tricky because certainly, you know, some people had the internet before it was mainstream. But overall, the trajectory clearly shows that these types of attacks seem to be increasing in frequency. So that would seem to be correlated with technological advances, internet rise, social media rise. And, of course, we see, as we saw in this case, that there are copycats. So there are attackers who are influenced and inspired by previous attackers. Certainly that's a problem as well.
And the question about young white men, are we doing, based on your study of portraits of killers, are we doing enough, and what do you recommend could be done?
Well, the whiteness of these shooters is a little overstated. Certainly the Virginia Tech shooter was not white. I found that about 62-63% of these attackers are white, which is the majority and is more than other types of violent crimes, but it's not 97%.
Is it our mental health infrastructure that needs to do more?
Well, that would help. Certainly that would help, but when I looked globally, countries with far more suicides than us do not have this problem.
Well, Adam Langford, thank you so much for joining us. Criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama and Deb Delvecchio Scully, clinical mental health specialist in trauma counseling. I'm Mina Kim.